not to my house. I live there, she says, pointing at Paradise Apartments. I don't come to this part of town very often. It's in the opposite direction of my house, so I rarely drive down this road. I honestly thought they condemned this place. I pull into the parking lot, and I intend to kill the engine and open her door for her, but she's already out of the truck before I even get it turned off. Thanks for the ride, she says, and for the coffee. She closes the door and spins around like that's how we're supposed to part. I open my door. Hey, wait. She pauses, but waits to turn around until I've reached her. She's hugging herself, chewing on her lip, scratching nervously at her arm. She looks up at me.
You don't have to say anything.
What do you mean?
I mean, I know what that was.
She waves a hand at my truck.
You don't have to ask for my number. I don't even have one.
How does she know what that was? I don't know what that was. My mind is still trying to process it. Maybe I should ask her. What was that? What does it mean? Can it happen again? I'm in uncharted territory. I've had one-night stands before, but things were discussed and agreed to prior to the sex. And it's always happened in a bed, or something close to it. But with her, the make-out just happened, and then it was interrupted, and it was in an alley of all places. I feel like an asshole. I have no idea what to say. I don't know where to put my hands because I feel like I should be hugging her goodbye, but it seems like she doesn't want me near her now. I slip my hands into the pockets of my jeans. I want to see you again. It's not a lie. Her eyes flicker from mine to her apartment building.
I'm not.
She sighs and then she just says,
No, thank you.
She says it so politely I can't even be upset. I stand in front of her apartment building and watch her walk away until she goes up the stairs and into an apartment and I can't see her anymore. And even then, I stay in the same spot because I think I'm shocked or, at the least, jarred. I don't know her at all, but I find her more intriguing than anyone else I've met in a long time. I want to ask her more questions. She never even answered the one question I asked about her life. Who the hell is she? Why do I feel the need to find out more about her?
Chapter 7. Kenna. Dear Scotty, when they say it's a small world, they aren't kidding. Tiny, minuscule, overcrowded. I'm only telling you this because I know you can't actually read these letters. But I saw Ledger's truck tonight and I thought I was going to cry. Actually, I was already crying because he said his name and I realized who he was and I was kissing him and I felt so guilty. So I embarrassingly ran outside and almost had a panic attack. But yeah, that damn truck. I can't believe he still has it. I still remember the night you pulled up in it to take me on our first date. I laughed because it was such a bright orange that I couldn't understand what kind of person would willingly choose that color. Over 300 letters I've written to you, and I only realized tonight while skimming the letters that not one of them details the first moment we met. I wrote about our actual first date, but never mentioned the first time we laid eyes on each other. I was working as a cashier at Dollar Days. It was the first job I applied for when I moved away from Denver. I knew no one, but I didn't mind it. I was in a new state and a new town, and no one held any preconceived notions of me. No one knew my mother. When you came through my line, I didn't notice you right away. I rarely looked at the customers, especially if they were guys my age. Guys my age had only disappointed me up to that point. I thought maybe I was supposed to be attracted to older men, or maybe even women, because no guy I had ever met who was my age made me feel good about myself Between the catcalls and the sexual expectations, I'd lost complete faith in the male population of my generation. We were a small store, and everything in the store was just a dollar, so people usually came through with carts full of stuff. You came through my line with one dinner plate. I wondered what kind of person only bought one dinner plate. Surely most people expect to have friends occasionally, or at least the hope for friends. But buying one plate felt like you expected to always eat alone. I rang up the plate and wrapped it before placing it in a sack and handing it to you. It wasn't until the second time you came through my line a few minutes later that I finally looked at your face. You were buying a second dinner plate. It made me feel better for you. I rang up the second plate. You handed me your dollar and some change. I handed you the sack, and that's when you smiled. You had me in that moment, although you probably didn't realize it. Your smile was like warmth sliding over me. It was dangerous and it was comfortable, and I didn't know what to do about those warring feelings, so I looked away from you. 2 minutes later, you were standing in line again with a third plate. I rang you up. You paid. I wrapped your plate and handed you your sack. But this time I spoke. "Come back soon," I said. You grinned and said, "If you insist." You circled the register and went back to the aisle that contained the plates. I didn't have any other customers, so I watched the aisle until you reappeared with a fourth plate and brought it to the register. I rang up the plate and said, "You know, you can buy more than one thing at a time."
"I know," you said. "But I only need one plate."
"Then why is this the fourth one you've bought?"
"Because I'm trying to work up the nerve to ask you out."
I had hoped that was why. I handed you your sack, wanting your fingers to touch mine. They did. It felt exactly as I imagined, like our hands were magnetic. It took a lot of effort just to pull my hand back. I tried to act nonchalant about your flirtation, because that's just what I'd always done with men. So I said, "It's against our policy for employees to date customers." There wasn't any firmness or truth to my voice at all. But I think you liked the game we were playing. So you said,
"Okay, give me a minute to rectify that."
You walked to the only other cashier in the store. You were only a few feet away, so I heard you say,
"I need to return these plates, please."
The other cashier had been on the phone with a customer during your four trips to the register, so I'm not sure she knew you were being facetious. She glanced at me from her register and made a face. I shrugged like I didn't know what was up with the guy who had four different receipts for four plates. And then I turned away from her to wait on another customer. You came through my line a few minutes later and slapped a return receipt on the counter.
"I'm no longer a customer. What now?"
I picked up the receipt, pretending to read it carefully. I handed it back to you and said, "I get off work at 7. You folded the receipt and didn't look at me when you said,
"See you in 3 hours.
I should have told you 6, because I ended up getting off work early. I spent the extra hour in the store next door buying a new outfit. You still hadn't shown up at 20 minutes past 7. So I had given up and was walking to my car when you sped into the parking lot and pulled up next to me. You rolled down your window and said,
"Sorry I'm late."
I was perpetually late, so I was in no place to judge you on your tardiness. But I sure did judge you based on your truck. I thought maybe you were insane or overconfident. It was an older Ford F-250, big double cab, the ugliest color of orange I'd ever seen. "I like your truck." I wasn't sure if I was telling the truth or if I was lying. It was such an ugly truck, it made me hate it. But because it was so ugly, it made me love that you were picking me up in it.
"It's not mine. It's my best friend's truck. My car is in the shop."
I was relieved it wasn't yours, but also a little disappointed because I found the color so amusing. You motioned for me to get in the truck. You looked proud and smelled like a candy cane. "Is that why you're late?
Your car broke down? You shook your head and said,
No, I had to break up with my girlfriend.
My head swung in your direction. You have a girlfriend?
Not anymore.
You shot me a coy look. But you had one when you asked me out earlier?
Yes, but by the time I purchased my third dinner plate, I knew I was going to break up with her. It was overdue,
you said.
We've both been wanting out of it for a while. We were just too comfortable to call it off.
You flipped on your blinker and pulled into a gas station and up to a gas pump.
My mother will be sad. My mother really likes her.
Mothers usually don't like me, I admitted. Or maybe it was more of a warning. You smiled.
I can see that. Mothers prefer to imagine their sons with wholesome-looking girls. You're too sexy to make a mother feel comfortable.
I wasn't one to get offended by a guy calling me sexy. I worked hard that day to look sexy. I spent a lot of money on the bra and low-cut shirt I had purchased 30 minutes earlier with the goal of making my breasts look store-bought. I appreciated the compliment, even if you were being a little tacky. As you got out to fill your friend's truck up with gas, I thought about the wholesome-looking girl whose heart you just broke simply because I agreed to go on a date with you, and I felt a bit like a snake in that moment. But even though I felt like a snake, I didn't plan on slithering away. I liked your energy so much. I planned to coil myself around you and never let go. When Ledger said his name against my lips earlier tonight, I almost said, Scotty's Ledger? But the question would have been pointless, because I knew in that instant that he was your Ledger. How many Ledgers can there be? I've never met one before. I was overwhelmed with questions, but Ledger kissed me and it ripped me in half because I wanted to kiss him back. But even more than that, I wanted to ask him questions about you. I wanted to say, what was Scotty like as a child? What did you love about him? Did he ever talk about me? Do you still talk to his parents? Have you met my daughter? Can you help me put all the pieces of my broken life back together? But I couldn't speak, because your best friend had his searing hot tongue in my mouth, and it felt like he was branding me with the word cheater. I don't know why it felt like I was cheating on you. You've been dead 5 years, and I kissed the prison guard, so it's not like you were even my last kiss. But my kiss with the prison guard didn't make me feel like I was cheating on you. That could be because the prison guard wasn't your best friend. Or maybe I felt like a cheater because I actually felt Ledger's kiss. It trickled all over me the way your kisses used to do. But then there was that added element of feeling like a cheater, or a liar, or trash, because Ledger didn't know me at all. To Ledger, he was being kissed by the transient girl he couldn't stop staring at all night. To me, I was being kissed by the hot bartender whose best friend died because of me. Everything exploded. I felt like I was shattering. I was allowing Ledger to touch me, knowing full well he'd probably rather stab me if he knew who I was. Pulling away from his kiss felt a little like trying to put out a forest fire with a nuclear bomb. I wanted to apologize. I wanted to escape. I felt like collapsing, thinking about how Ledger probably knew you better than I did. I hated that the one guy I ran into in this town is the one guy I should be avoiding. Ledger didn't turn away when I cried, though. He did what you would have done. He put his arms around me and let me be however I needed to be. And it felt nice, because I hadn't been held like that since you. I closed my eyes and pretended your best friend was my ally, that he was on my side. I pretended he was holding me despite what I'd done to you, and he wanted to help me heal. I also let it happen, because if Ledger is back in this town, and he's still driving the truck I met you in all those years ago, then that means he's a fan of routine. And there's a huge possibility that our daughter is part of Ledger's routine. Is it possible I'm only one person away from DM?
If you could see the pages I'm writing this letter on, you'd see the tear stains. Crying seems to be the only thing left in life that I'm good at. Crying and making bad decisions. And, of course, I'm good at writing you bad poetry. I'll leave you with one I wrote on the bus ride back to this town. I have a daughter I have never held. She has a scent I have never smelled. She has a name I have never yelled. She has a mother who has already failed. Love, Kenna.
Chapter 8. Ledger. I didn't park in the garage when I got home last night. DM likes to wake up and look out her window in the mornings to make sure I'm home. And when I leave my truck in the garage, Grace says it makes DM sad. I've lived across the street from them since DM was 8 months old. But if I don't count the years I moved out of this house and lived in Denver, I've technically been in this house my entire life. My parents haven't lived here in several years, even though they're both passed out in the guest room right now. They bought the RV when my father retired, and they travel the country now. I bought the house from them when I moved back, and they loaded up and left. I figured it would last a year at the most, but it's been over 4 years now, and they aren't showing any signs of slowing down. I just wish they'd warn me before they show up. Maybe I should download a GPS app to their phones, so I'll have some kind of warning in the future. Not that I don't like their visits. It would just be nice to be able to prepare for them. This is why I'm building a privacy gate at my new house. Eventually. It's slow going because Roman and I are doing a lot of the work ourselves. Every Sunday from sunup until sundown, I drive up to Cheshire Ridge with Roman and we work on it. I contract out for the more difficult stuff, but we've completed a good chunk of the build ourselves. After 2 years of Sundays, the house is finally starting to come together. I'm maybe 6 months from moving in. Where are you going? I spin around when I reach the garage door. My father is standing outside the guest bedroom. He's in his underwear. DM has T-ball. You guys want to come? Nope. Too hungover for kids today. And we really need to get back on the road. You're already leaving? We'll be back in a few weeks. My father gives me a hug. Your mother is still asleep, but I'll tell her you said bye. Maybe give me a heads up before the next visit, and I'll take off work. My father shakes his head. Nah. We like seeing the surprise on your face when we show up unannounced. He heads into the bathroom and closes the door. I walk through the garage and toward Patrick and Grace's house across the street. I'm hoping DM isn't in a talkative mood because my concentration is going to be shit today. All I can think about is the girl from last night and how much I want to see her again. I wonder if it would be weird if I left a note on her door. I knock on Patrick and Grace's front door and then walk in. We're all back and forth at each other's houses so much, at one point we got tired of saying, "It's open." It's always open. Grace is in the kitchen with DM. DM is sitting in the center of the table with her legs crossed and a bowl of eggs in her lap. She never sits in chairs. She's always on top of things, like the back of the couch, the kitchen bar, the kitchen table. She's a climber. You're still in your pajamas, Dee. I take the bowl of eggs from her and point down the hallway. Get dressed. We gotta go. She runs to her room to put on her T-ball uniform.
I thought the game was at 10, Grace says. I would have had her ready.
It is, but I've got Gatorade duty. So I have to run by the store, and then I have to swing by and pick up Roman. I lean against the counter and grab a tangerine. I peel it open while Grace starts the dishwasher. She blows a piece of hair out of her face.
She wants a swing set, she says. One of those ridiculously big ones like the one you used to have in your backyard. Her friend Nyla from school got one, and you know we can't say no. It'll be her 5th birthday.
I still have it.
You do? Where?
It's in the shed in pieces, but I can help Patrick put it back together. Shouldn't be too hard.
You think it's still in good shape?
Was when I took it apart. I failed to tell her Scotty is the reason I took it apart. I got angry every time I looked at it after he died. I put another piece of tangerine in my mouth and reroute my thoughts. I can't believe she'll be 5. Grace sighs.
I know.
Unreal. Unfair. Patrick pops into the kitchen and tousles my hair like I'm not almost 30 and 3 inches taller than him. Hey, kid. He reaches around me and grabs one of the tangerines. Did Grace tell you we can't make the game today?
I haven't yet, Grace says.
She rolls her eyes, her annoyed gaze landing on me.
My sister is in the hospital. Elective surgery, she's fine. But we have to drive to her house and feed her cats.
What's she getting done this time? Grace waves a hand at her face.
Something with her eyes. Who knows? She's 5 years older than me, but looks 10 years younger.
Patrick covers Grace's mouth. Stop. You're perfect. Grace laughs and shoves his hand away.
I've never seen them fight. Not even when Scotty was a kid.
My parents bicker a lot, and it's mostly in fun. But I've never even seen Grace and Patrick bicker in the 20 years I've known them.
I want that.
Someday. I don't have time for it yet, though. I work too much and feel like I'm slowly running myself into the ground. I need to make a change if I ever want to keep a girl long enough to have what Patrick and Grace have.
Ledger!
DM yells from her bedroom.
Help me!
I walk down the hallway to go see what she needs. She's on her knees in her closet, digging around.
I can't find my other boot. I need my boot.
She's holding one red cowboy boot and rummaging around for the other. Why do you need boots? You need your cleats.
I don't want to wear my cleats today. I want to wear my boots.
Her cleats are next to her bed, so I grab them. You can't wear boots to play baseball. Here, hop on the bed so I can help you put on your cleats. She stands up and flings the second red boot onto her bed.
Found it.
She giggles and climbs onto her bed and starts putting on her boots.
Diem, it's baseball. People don't wear boots to play baseball.
I am. I'm wearing boots today.
No, you can't.
I shut up. I don't have time to argue with her, and I know once she gets to the field and sees all the other kids with their cleats, she'll let me take off her boots. I help her put on the boots and take the cleats with us when I carry her out of the room. Grace meets us at the door and hands DM a juice pouch.
Have fun today.
She kisses DM on the cheek, and then Grace's eyes go to DM's boots. Don't ask, I say, as I open their front door.
Bye, Nana,
DM says. Patrick is in the kitchen, and when DM fails to tell him goodbye, he stomps dramatically toward us. What about no-no? Patrick wanted to go by Papa when DM started talking, but for whatever reason, she called Grace Nana and Patrick No-No. And it was so funny, Grace and I enforced it enough that it finally stuck.
Bye, No-No,
DM says, giggling.
We may not get back before you, Grace says. You mind keeping her if we aren't?
I don't know why Grace always asks me. I've never said no. I'll never say no. Take your time. I'll take her somewhere for lunch. I put DM down when we get outside.
McDonald's,
she says. I don't want McDonald's, I say as we cross the street toward my truck.
McDonald's drive-thru.
I open the back door to my truck and help her into her booster seat.
How about Mexican food?
Nope. McDonald's.
Chinese? We haven't had Chinese food in a long time.
McDonald's.
I'll tell you what.
If you wear your cleats when we get to the game, we can eat McDonald's. I get her seatbelt buckled. She shakes her head. No, I want to wear my boots. I don't want lunch anyway. I'm full. You'll be hungry by lunchtime. I won't. I ate a dragon. I'm going to be full forever. Sometimes I worry about how many stories she tells, but she's so convincing I'm more impressed than concerned. I don't know at what age a child should know the difference between a lie and using their imagination, but I'll leave that up to Grace and Patrick. I don't want to stifle my favorite part of her. I pull onto the street. You ate a dragon? A whole dragon?
Yeah, but he was a baby dragon. That's how he fit in my stomach.
Where'd you find a baby dragon?
Walmart.
They sell baby dragons at Walmart? She proceeds to tell me all about how baby dragons are sold at Walmart, but you have to have a special coupon, and only kids can eat them. By the time I make it to Roman's, she's explaining how they're cooked.
With salt and shampoo, she says.
You aren't supposed to eat shampoo.
You don't eat it. You use it to cook the dragon.
Oh, silly me. Roman gets in the truck, and he looks about as excited as someone going to a funeral. He hates T-ball days. He's never been a kid person. The only reason he helps me coach is that none of the other parents would do it, and since he works for me, I added it to his schedule. He's the only person I know who gets paid to coach T-ball, but he doesn't seem to feel guilty about it.
Hi, Roman,
DM says from the back seat in a sing-song voice. I've only had one cup of coffee. Don't talk to me. Roman is 27, but he and DM have met somewhere in the middle with their love-hate relationship, because they both act 12. DM starts tapping the back of his headrest.
Wake up, wake up, wake up!
Roman rolls his head until he's looking at me. All this shit you do to help little kids in your spare time isn't going to gain you any points in an afterlife because religion is a social construct created by societies who wanted to regulate their people, which makes heaven a concept. We could be sleeping right now. Wow. I'd hate to see you before coffee. I back out of his driveway. If heaven is conceptual, what is hell? The T-ball field.
Chapter 9. Kenna. I've been to 6 different places trying to find a job, and it isn't even 10 in the morning yet. They've all gone the same. They give me an application, ask me about my experience. I have to tell them I have none. I have to tell them why. Then they apologize, but not before looking me up and down. I know what they're thinking. It's the same thing my landlord Ruth said when she saw me for the first time. Didn't expect you to look like this. People think women who go to prison have a certain look, that we're a certain way. But we're mothers, wives, daughters, humans. And all we want is just to catch one fucking break. Just one. The 7th place I try is a grocery store. It's a little farther from my apartment than I'd like, almost 2.5 miles. But I've exhausted everything else between this store and my apartment. I'm sweating when I enter the store, so I freshen up in the bathroom. I'm washing my hands in the sink when a short woman with silky black hair enters the bathroom. She doesn't go into a stall. She just leans against the wall and closes her eyes. She has a name badge on. Amy. When she opens her eyes, she notices I'm staring at her shoes. She's wearing a pair of moccasins with white and red beads in the shape of a circle on top of them. You like? She asks, lifting her foot and tilting it from one side to the other. Yeah, they're beautiful. My grandmother makes them. We're supposed to wear sneakers here, but the general manager has never said anything about my shoes. I think he's scared of me. I look down at my muddy sneakers. I recoil at the sight of them. I didn't realize I was walking around with such dirty shoes. I can't apply for a job like this. I take one of them off and start washing it in the sink. I'm hiding, the woman says. I don't normally hang out in bathrooms, but there's an old lady in the store who always complains about everything, and I'm honestly just not in the mood for her bullshit today. I have a 2-year-old, and she didn't sleep all night, and I really wanted to call in sick today, but I'm the shift manager, and shift managers don't call in sick. We show up.
And hide in bathrooms.
She grins.
Exactly.
I switch shoes and start washing the other one. I have a lump in my throat when I say,
Are you guys hiring?
I'm looking for a job.
Yeah, but it's probably not anything you're interested in.
She must not see the desperation on my face.
What are you hiring for?
Grocery bagger. It's not full-time, but we usually leave those spots open for teenagers with special needs.
Oh, well, I don't want to take a job away from anyone.
No, it's not that, she says. We just don't have many applicants because of the low hours. But we really are in need of part-time help. It's about 20 hours a week.
That won't even pay rent. But if I worked hard enough, I could possibly work my way into a different position.
I can do it until someone with special needs applies. I could really use the money. Amy looks me up and down.
Why are you so desperate? The pay is shit.
I put my shoe back on. I tie my shoe, stalling the inevitable admission.
I just got out of prison.
I say it fast and confidently, like it doesn't bother me as much as it does.
But I'm not. I can do this. I won't let you down and I won't be any trouble.
Amy laughs. It's a loud laugh, but when I don't laugh with her, she folds her arms over her chest and tilts her head.
Oh, shit. You're serious?
I nod.
Yeah. But if it's against policy, I totally get it. It's not a big deal.
She waves a flippant hand.
Eh, we don't really have a policy. We aren't a chain. We can hire whoever we want.
To be honest, I'm obsessed with Orange is the New Black. So if you'll promise to let me know which parts of the show are bullshit, I'll give you an application.
I could cry.
Instead, I fake a smile.
I've heard so many jokes about that show. I guess I need to watch it.
Amy rolls her head.
Yes, yes, yes. Best show, best cast. Come with me.
I follow her to the customer service desk at the front of the store. She digs around in a drawer and finds an application, then hands it to me along with a pen.
If you fill it out while you're here, I can get you in for Monday orientation.
I take the application from her, and I want to thank her. I want to hug her. I want to tell her she's changing my life. But I just smile and quietly take my application to a bench by the front door. I fill out my full name, but put quotation marks around my middle name, so they'll know to call me Nicole. I can't be wearing a name tag that says Kenna in this town. Someone will recognize it. Then they'll gossip. I get halfway through the first page when I'm interrupted.
Hey.
My fingers clench the pen tightly when I hear his voice. I slowly lift my head, and Ledger is standing in front of me with a grocery cart full of about a dozen packs of Gatorade. I flip the application over, hoping he didn't already see my name across the top of it. I swallow and attempt to appear to be in a more stable mood than all the moods he witnessed from me yesterday. I gesture toward the Gatorade.
Special at the bar tonight?
A subtle relief seems to wash over him, like he was expecting me to tell him to fuck off. He taps one of the packs of Gatorade.
T-ball coach.
I look away from him, because for some reason that answer makes me uneasy. He doesn't look like a T-ball coach. Those lucky mothers. Oh no. He's a T-ball coach. Does he have a kid? A kid and a wife? Did I almost sleep with a married T-ball coach? I tap the pen on the back of the clipboard.
Are you, you aren't married, are you?
His grin tells me no. He doesn't even need to say it, but he shakes his head and says,
Single.
Then motions toward the clipboard on my lap.
You applying for a job?
Yep. I glance toward the customer service desk, and Amy is eyeing me. I need this job so bad. but I'm afraid this might make it look like I'm going to be distracted by sexy bartenders while I'm on the clock. I look away from her, wondering if Ledger standing here talking to me is hurting my chances. I flip the clipboard back over, but tilt it so that he isn't able to see my name. I start writing in my address, hoping he walks away. He doesn't. He pushes his cart to the side so a guy can get around him, and then he leans his right shoulder against the wall and says,
"I was hoping I'd run into you again."
I'm not going to do this right now. I'm not going to lead him on when he has no idea who I am. I'm also not going to risk this job by fraternizing with customers. "Can you go?" I whisper it, but loud enough for him to hear it. He makes a face.
"Did I do something wrong?"
"No, I just really need to finish this." His jaw tightens and he pushes off the wall.
"It's just that you act like you're mad and I feel kind of bad about last night."
"I'm fine." I look back at the customer service desk and Amy is still staring. I face Ledger and plead with him. "I really need this job. And right now, my potential new boss keeps looking over here, and no offense, but you're covered in tattoos and look like trouble. And I need her to think I'm not going to give her any issues at all. I don't care what happened last night. It was mutual. It was fine." He nods slowly and then grips the handle of his shopping cart.
"It was fine,"
he repeats, seemingly offended. For a moment, I feel bad, but I'm not going to lie to him. He put his hand down my jeans, and if we hadn't been interrupted, we probably would have ended up fucking. In his truck. How spectacular could it have been? But he's right. It was more than fine. I can't even look at him without staring at his mouth. He's a good kisser, and it's toying with my head right now, because I have so many more important things going on in my life than his mouth. He stands silent for a couple of seconds, and then reaches into a sack in his cart. He pulls out a brown bottle.
"I bought caramel, in case you come back."
He tosses the bottle into the cart.
"Anyway, good luck."
He looks uneasy when he turns and walks out the door. I try to continue filling out the form, but I'm shaking now. I feel like I've got a bomb strapped to me, and it ticks down in his presence, getting closer and closer to exploding my secrets all over him. I finish filling out the application, but my handwriting is sloppy because of my trembling hands. When I return to customer service and hand it to Amy, she says, "Hey, your boyfriend?" I play dumb. "Who?" "Ledger Ward." "Ward?" The bar is called Ward's. He owns the bar? I shake my head, answering Amy's question. "No, I hardly know him." "Shame. He's a hot commodity around here since he and Leah broke up." She says that like I'm supposed to know who Leah is. I guess in a town this size, most people know most people. I glance back at the door Ledger disappeared through. "I'm not in the market for a hot commodity. Just a lukewarm job." Amy laughs and then browses my application for a moment. "Did you grow up here?" "No, I'm from Denver. I came here for college." That's a lie. I never went to college. But it's a college town, and my intentions were to eventually go. That just never happened.
"Oh yeah? What's your degree in?"
"Didn't finish. That's why I'm back," I lie. "Registering for next semester."
"This job is perfect for that. We can work around your classes. Be here Monday at 8 for orientation. Do you have a driver's license?"
I nod. "Yeah, I'll bring it." I leave out the fact that I just got my driver's license last month, after months of working to get it reinstated. "Thank you." I try to say that with as little eagerness in my voice as possible. But so far, things are working out. I have an apartment and now a job. Now, I just need to find my daughter. I turn to walk away, but Amy says,
"Wait. Do you want to know how much you're making?"
"Oh, yeah, of course."
"Minimum wage. Ridiculous, I know. I don't own this place or I'd raise it."
She leans forward and lowers her voice.
"You know, you can probably get a job at the Lowe's warehouse. They pay twice that starting out."
"I tried online last week. They won't hire me with my record.
Oh, bummer. Well, see you Monday then.
Before I go, I tap my fist on the counter and ask a question I probably shouldn't ask. One more thing. You know the guy I was talking to? Ledger? She raises an amused brow.
What about him?
Does he have kids?
Just a niece or something. She comes in here with him sometimes. Cute girl, but I'm pretty sure he's single and childless.
A niece? Or could it be his deceased best friend's daughter? Does he shop here with my daughter? I somehow force a smile through the onslaught of emotions suddenly spiraling through me. I thank her again, but then I leave in a hurry, hoping by some miracle Ledger's truck is still outside and that my daughter is in the truck with him. I look around the parking lot, but he's already gone. My stomach sinks, but I can still feel the adrenaline disguised as hope running through my body. Because now I know he coaches T-ball, and DM more than likely plays on his team. Because why else would he coach if he doesn't have children of his own? I debate going straight to the T-ball field. But I need to do this right. I want to speak with Patrick and Grace first.
Chapter 10. Ledger. I'm in the dugout, pulling the equipment out of the bag when Grady slips his fingers through the chain-link fence, gripping it. So, who was she? I pretend not to know what he's talking about. Who was who? The girl you had in your truck last night. Grady's eyes are bloodshot. It looks like the night shift change is taking a toll on him. A customer. I was just giving her a ride home. Grady's wife, Whitney, is standing next to him now. At least the rest of the mom brigade isn't with her, because I can tell immediately by the way she's looking at me that everyone on the T-ball field is already talking. I can only be confronted by one couple at a time.
Grady said you had a girl in your truck last night.
I shoot Grady a look, and he holds his hands up helplessly, like his wife yanked the information out of him. It was no one, I repeat. Just giving a customer a ride home. I wonder how many times I'm going to have to repeat this today.
Who was she?
Whitney asks. No one you know. We know everyone around here, Grady says. She's not from here, I say. I might be lying. I might be telling the truth. I wouldn't know since I know very little about her, other than what she tastes like. Destin has been working on his swing, Grady says, changing the subject to his son. Wait till you see what he can do. Grady wants to be the envy of all the other fathers. I don't get it. T-ball is supposed to be fun, but people like him put so much competitiveness into it and ruin the sport. 2 weeks ago, Grady almost got into a fight with the umpire. He probably would have hit him if Roman hadn't pushed him off the field. Not sure getting that heated over a T-ball game is a good look for anyone, but he takes his son's sports very seriously. Me, not so much. Sometimes I wonder if it's because DM isn't my daughter. If she were, would I get angry over a sport that doesn't even keep score? I don't know that I could love a biological child more than I love DM, so I doubt I'd be any different when it comes to their sports. Some of the parents assume that since I played professional football, I'd be more competitive. I've dealt with competitive coaches my whole life, though. I agreed to coach this team specifically to prevent some competitive asshole from coming in and setting a bad example for DM. The kids are supposed to be warming up, but DM is standing behind home plate, shoving T-balls into the pockets of her baseball pants. She's got two in each pocket, and now she's trying to shove a third in. Her pants are starting to sag from the weight. I walk over to her and kneel. D, you can't take all the T-balls.
They're dragon eggs, she says. I'm going to plant them in my yard and grow baby dragons.
I toss the balls one at a time to Roman. That's not how dragons grow. The mama dragon has to sit on the eggs. You don't bury them in the yard.
DM bends forward to pick up a pebble, and I notice she has two balls stuffed down the back of her shirt. I untuck her shirt, and the balls fall to her feet. I kick them to Roman.
Did I grow in an egg?
She asks. No, Dee. You're human. Humans don't grow in eggs. We grow in... I stop talking, because I was about to say, we grow in our mother's bellies. But I'm always careful to avoid any talk of mothers or fathers around Diem. I don't want her to start asking me questions I can't answer.
What do we grow in? She asks. Trees?
Shit. I put my hand on Diem's shoulder and completely ignore her question because I have no idea what Grace or Patrick has told her about how babies are made. This isn't my wheelhouse. I wasn't prepared for this conversation. I yell for all the kids to go to the dugout, and luckily Diem is distracted by one of her friends and walks away from me. I blow out a breath, relieved the conversation ended where it did. I dropped Roman off at the bar to spare him a trip to McDonald's. And yes, we're at McDonald's, even though Diem didn't wear her cleats at all during the game, because she gets her way with me more often than she doesn't. Choose your battles, they say. But what happens when you never choose any?
I don't want to play t-ball anymore, Diem says out of the blue.
She's dipping her french fry into honey when she makes that decision. The honey dribbles down her hand. I try to get her to eat her fries with ketchup because it's a lot easier to clean, but she wouldn't be DM if she didn't do everything the hardest way possible. You don't like t-ball anymore? She shakes her head and licks her wrist. That's fine, but we only have a few more games, and you made a commitment.
What's a commitment?
It's when you agree to do something. You agreed to be part of the team. If you quit in the middle of the season, your friends will be sad. You think you can make it through the rest of the season?
If we can have McDonald's after all the games.
I narrow my eyes in her direction. Why do I feel like I'm getting swindled?
What does swindled mean? She asks.
It means you're trying to trick me into getting you McDonald's. DM grins and eats her last fry. I put all our trash on the tray. I grab her hand to lead her out of the store and remember the honey. Her hands are as sticky as a flytrap. I keep wet wipes in my truck for this very reason. A couple of minutes later, she's buckled up in her booster seat, and I'm scrubbing her hands and arms with the wet wipe when she says,
"When is my mom getting a bigger car?"
She drives a minivan. How big of a car does she need?
Not Nana, DM says. My mom. Skylar said my mom never comes to my t-ball games, and I told her she will when she gets a bigger car.
I stop wiping her hands. She never brings up her mother. This is twice in one day we've brushed the conversation. I guess she's getting to that age, but I have no idea what Grace or Patrick has told her about Kenna, and I have absolutely no idea why she's asking about her mother's car. Who told you your mom needed a bigger car?
Nana. She said my mom's car isn't big enough, and that's why I live with her and Nono.
That's confusing. I shake my head and throw the wipes in a sack. I don't know. Ask your Nana. I close her door and text Grace as I'm circling around to the driver's side of my truck. Why does DM think her mother isn't in her life because she needs a bigger car? We're a few miles away from McDonald's when Grace calls. I make sure not to answer it on speaker. Hey, DM and I are on our way back. It's my way of letting Grace know I can't say much on my end. Grace sucks in a breath like she's getting ready for a long explanation to my text.
Okay, so last week, DM asked me why she doesn't live with her mother. I didn't know what to say, so I told her she lives with me because her mother's car isn't big enough to fit all of us. It was the first lie I could come up with. I panicked, Ledger.
I'd say so.
We plan on telling her, but how do you tell a child her mother went to prison? She doesn't even know what prison is.
I'm not judging, I say. I just want to make sure we're on the same page. We should probably come up with a more accurate version of the truth, though.
I know. She's just so young.
She's starting to get curious.
I know. Just, if she asks again, tell her I'll explain it to her.
I did. Prepare for questions.
Great, she says with a sigh. How did the game go?
Good. She wore the red boots and got McDonald's. Grace laughs. You're a sucker. Yeah, tell me something new. See you soon. I end the call and glance into the back seat. DM's face is full of concentration. What are you thinking, D?
I want to be in a movie,
DM says. Oh, yeah? You want to be an actress?
No, I want to be in a movie.
I know, that's called being an actress.
Then, yeah, that's what I want to be, an actress. I want to be in cartoons.
I don't tell her cartoons are just voices and drawings. I think you'll be a great cartoon actress.
I will be. I'm going to be a horse, or a dragon, or a mermaid.
Or a unicorn, I suggest. She grins and looks out her window. I love her imagination, but she definitely didn't get it from Scotty. His mind was more concrete than a sidewalk.
Chapter 11. Kenna. I've never seen a picture of DM. I don't know if she looks like me or Scotty. Are her eyes blue or brown? Is her smile honest like her father's? Does she laugh like me? Is she happy? That's my only hope for her. I want her to be happy. I have complete faith in Grace and Patrick. I know they loved Scotty, and it's obvious they love DM. They loved her before she was even born. They started fighting for custody the day they were told I was pregnant. The baby didn't even have fully developed lungs, but they were already fighting for its first breath. I lost the custody battle before DM was even born. There aren't many rights a mother has when she's sentenced to several years in prison. The judge said, because of the nature of our situation and the duress I'd caused to Scotty's family, he could not in good conscience honor my request for visitation rights. Nor would he force Scotty's parents to maintain the relationship between my daughter and me while I was in prison. I was told I could petition the court for rights upon my release. But since my rights were terminated, there's probably very little I can do. Between Diem's birth and my release almost 5 years later, there has been little anyone could or would do for me. All I have is this intangible hope I try to cling to with childlike hands. I was praying Scotty's parents just needed time. I assumed, ignorantly, that they would eventually see a need for me to be in DM's life. There wasn't much I could do from my isolated position in the world. But now that I'm out, I've thought long and hard about how I should go about this. I have no idea what to expect. I don't even know what kind of people they are. I only met them once when Scotty and I were dating, and that didn't go over very well. I've tried to find them online, but their profiles are extremely private. There wasn't a single picture of DM online that I could locate. I even looked up all of Scotty's friends whose names I could remember, but I couldn't remember very many, and all their profiles were private. I knew very little about Scotty's life before he met me. And I wasn't with him long enough to truly get to know his friends or his family. 6 months out of the 22 years he lived. Why is everyone from his life so locked down? Is it because of me? Are they afraid of this very thing happening? Me showing up, me hoping to be a part of my daughter's life. I know they hate me, and they have every right to hate me. But part of me has been living with them for the past 4 years in Diem. My hope is that they found a sliver of forgiveness for me through my daughter. Time heals all wounds, right? Except I didn't leave them with a simple wound. I left them with a casualty. One so heartbreaking, there's a possibility it will never be forgiven. It's hard not to cling to hope, though, when all I've been able to do or look forward to is this moment. It's either going to complete me or destroy me. There is no in-between. 4 more minutes before I find out. I'm more nervous in this moment than I was in the courtroom 5 years ago. I grip the rubber starfish tightly in my hand. It's the only toy they had for sale at the gas station next door to my apartment. I could have had the cab driver take me to Target or Walmart, but they're both in the opposite direction of where I'm hoping DM still lives, and I can't afford that much cab fare. After I got hired at the grocery store today, I walked home and took a nap. I didn't want to show up while DM wasn't at Grace and Patrick's. And if Amy is right, and Ledger doesn't have kids, it's a reasonable assumption that the little girl he coaches in T-ball is my daughter. And judging by the amount of Gatorade he bought, he was preparing for a long day with a lot of teams, which, using deductive reasoning, would mean it would be hours before DM was back home. I waited as long as I could. I know the bar opens at 5, which means Ledger will likely be taking DM home before then. And I really don't want Ledger to be there when I arrive. So I timed my cab ride to get me there at 5:15. I didn't want to arrive later than that, because I don't want to show up when they're having dinner, or after she's gone to bed. I want to do everything right. I don't want to do anything that will make Patrick or Grace feel more threatened by my presence than they probably already will be. I don't want them to ask me to leave before I can even plead my case. In a perfect world, they'll open their front door for me and allow me to reunite with the daughter I've never held. In a perfect world, their son would still be alive. I wonder what I'll see in their eyes when they find me at their front door. Will it be shock? Hatred? How much does Grace despise me? I try to put myself in Grace's shoes sometimes. I try to imagine the hatred she holds for me. What it must feel like from her perspective. Sometimes, I lie in bed and close my eyes and try to justify all the reasons this woman is keeping me from knowing my daughter, so that I don't hate her back. I think, Kenna, imagine your Grace. Imagine you have a son. A beautiful young man that you love more than life, more than any afterlife. And he's handsome and he's accomplished. But most importantly, he's kind. Everyone tells you this. Other parents wish their children could be more like your son. You smile because you're proud of him. You're so proud of him, even when he brings home his new girlfriend, the one you heard moaning too loud in the middle of the night, the girlfriend you saw looking around the room while everyone else was praying over dinner, the girlfriend you caught smoking at 11 at night on your back patio. But you didn't say anything. You just hoped your perfect son would outgrow her soon. Imagine you get a phone call from your son's roommate, asking if you know where he is. He was supposed to show up for work early that day, but for whatever reason, he didn't show. Imagine your worry. Because your son shows. He always shows. Imagine he doesn't answer his cell phone when you call to see why he didn't show. Imagine you start to panic as the hours stretch on. Normally you can feel him, but you can't feel him today. You feel full of fear and empty of pride. Imagine you start to make phone calls. You call his college, you call his employer. You'd even call the girlfriend you don't much care for, if only you knew her number. Imagine you hear a car door slam, and you breathe a sigh of relief. Only to fall to the floor when you see the police at your door. Imagine hearing things like, I'm sorry, and accident, and car wreck, and didn't make it. Imagine yourself not dying in that moment. Imagine being forced to go on, to live through that awful night, to wake up the next day, to be asked to identify his body, his lifeless body. A body you created, breathed life into, grew inside of you, taught to walk and talk and run and be kind to others. Imagine touching his cold, cold face. Your tears falling onto the plastic bag he's tucked into. Your scream stuck in your throat, silent like the screams you've had in nightmares. And yet you still live. Somehow. Somehow you go on without the life you made. You grieve. You're too weak to even plan his funeral. You keep wondering why your perfect son, your kind son, would be so reckless. You are so devastated, but your heart keeps beating, over and over, reminding you of all the heartbeats your son will never feel. Imagine it gets even worse. Imagine that. Imagine when you think you're at rock bottom, you're introduced to a whole new cliff you get to fall off. When you're told your son wasn't even driving the car that was going way too fast on the gravel. Imagine being told the wreck was her fault. The girl who smoked the cigarette and didn't close her eyes during dinner prayer and moaned too loud in your quiet house. Imagine being told she was careless and so unkind with the life you grew. Imagine being told she left him there. Fled, they said. Imagine being told they found her the next day, in her bed, hungover, covered in mud and gravel, and your kind son's blood. Imagine being told your perfect son had a perfect pulse and might have lived a perfect life, if only he could have had that wreck with a perfect girl. Imagine finding out it didn't have to be this way. He wasn't even dead. 6 hours, they estimated, he had lived. Several feet he had crawled, searching for you, needing your help, bleeding, dying. For hours. Imagine finding out that the girl who moaned too loud and smoked the cigarette on your patio at 11 o'clock at night could have saved him. One phone call she didn't make, 3 numbers she never dialed. 5 years she served for his life. Like you didn't raise him for 18, watch him flourish on his own for 4, and maybe could have gotten 50 more years with him had she not cut them short. Imagine having to go on after that. Now, imagine that girl, the one you hoped your son would grow out of. Imagine after all the pain she's caused you, she decides to show back up in your life. Imagine she has the nerve to knock on your door. Imagine she smiles in your face, asks about her daughter, expects to be a part of the tiny little beautiful life your son miraculously left behind. Just imagine it. Imagine having to look into the eyes of the girl who left your son to crawl several feet during his death while she took a nap in her bed. Imagine what you would say to her after all this time. Imagine all the ways you could hurt her back. It's easy to see why Grace hates me. The closer I get to their house, the more I'm starting to hate me too. I'm not even sure why I'm here without being more prepared. This isn't going to be easy. And even though I've been preparing myself for this moment every day for 5 years, I've never actually rehearsed it. The cab driver turns the car onto Scotty's old street. I feel like I'm sinking into the back seat with a heaviness unlike anything I've ever experienced before. When I see their house, my fear becomes audible. I make a noise in the back of my throat that surprises me, but it's taking all the effort inside me to keep my tears at bay. DM could be inside that house right now. I'm about to cross a yard that DM has played in. I'm about to knock on a door that DM has opened. $12 even, the driver says. I fish $15 out of my pocket and tell him to keep the change. I feel like I float out of the car. It's such a weird feeling. I glance into the back seat to make sure I'm not still sitting there. I contemplate asking the driver to wait, but that would be prematurely admitting defeat. I'll figure out how to get home later. Right now, I cling to the impossible dream that it'll be hours before I'm asked to leave. The driver pulls away as soon as I close the door, and I'm left standing on the opposite side of the street from their house. The sun is still hanging bright in the western sky. I wished I'd have waited until dark. I feel like an open target, vulnerable to whatever is about to come at me. I want to hide. I need more time. I haven't even practiced what I'm going to say yet. I've thought about it constantly, but I've never practiced it out loud. My breaths become harder and harder to control. I put my hands on the back of my head and breathe in and out, in and out. Their living room curtains aren't open, so I don't feel like my presence is known yet. I sit down on the curb and take a moment to gather myself before walking over there. I feel like my thoughts are scattered at my feet, and I need to pick them up one at a time and place them in order. 1. Apologize. 2. Express my gratitude. 3. Beg for their mercy. I should have dressed better. I'm in jeans and the same Mountain Dew t-shirt I had on yesterday. It was the cleanest outfit I had. But now that I'm looking down at myself, I want to cry. I don't want to meet my daughter for the first time while wearing a Mountain Dew t-shirt. How are Patrick and Grace expected to take me seriously when I'm not even dressed seriously? I shouldn't have rushed over here. I should have given this more thought. I'm starting to panic. I wish I had a friend.
Nicole?
I turn toward the sound of his voice. I crane my neck until my eyes meet Ledger's. Under normal circumstances, seeing him here would shock me, but I'm already at max capacity for things to feel. So my thought process is more along the lines of an apathetic, great, of course. There's a sharp intensity in the way he's looking at me that sends a chill up my arms.
What are you doing here?
He asks. Nothing. Fuck. My eyes flicker across the street. Then I look behind Ledger at what I'm assuming is his house. I remember Scotty saying Ledger grew up across the street from him. What are the odds that he would still live here? I have no idea what to do. I stand up. My feet feel like weights. I look at Ledger, but he's no longer looking at me. He's looking across the street at Scotty's old house. He runs a hand across his jaw, and there's a fresh, disturbing look on his face. He says,
"Why were you staring at that house?"
He's looking at the ground, then across the street, then toward the sun. But then his eyes land on me after I failed to answer his question. And he's a completely different person than the man I saw at the grocery store today. He's no longer the fluid guy who moves around the bar like he's on rollerblades.
Your name isn't Nicole.
He says it like it's a depressing realization. I wince. He's put it all together. Now he looks like he wants to rip it all apart. He points at his house.
Go.
The word is sharp and demanding.